Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time.
We are so wasteful in classical music. We waste...
How so?
Think how much product... Like, first of all, we waste the opportunity to be a for-profit mindset organization and field. Hmm. Our industry is so content being a 501c3 mindset. We waste... so much. Every rehearsal we're wasting. Either it's a chance to bring young people into the hall, to bring donors into the hall, to record them and create content. Every single player that we leave without talking to them and asking them questions or about asking them just how their day's doing, we're compromising our products. You know, we're so uncreative, and yet we boast being the most creative art form on the planet. It's changing everything. And also it's being humble enough to look at other industries for inspiration, which mm-hmm. We're also not very good at that. You know, how many executive directors have taken the time to go look at MLB, Major League Baseball in the 80s and see how they recovered, see how they developed, how they came back from the brink of pretty much the entire league not being televised anymore? Or how is classical music looking at industries where they have bad public perception, like nuclear energy? And what are they doing to combat that? Because there are strides being made, but not so much by classical music. We're very, very stuck in our ways.
Well, and we're so focused on the product, which we do a pretty good job at, but we lose sight that it's everything around that. That is what...
The product is flawless.
Yeah.
Classical music is exceptional whether or not we are good marketers or whether or not we get people into the concert hall. Its abilities and supremacy is there without us. We constantly hold it back.
I love that we're the ones holding it back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Without doubt. And it's a lot of taking care of the personal interactions with both audience and player. There are so many musicians who are so done. They're so done with how the industry's been running. You think about the star oboist who won his seat, you know, at 24 coming out of Juilliard. Wow, how exciting that person was. How excited they were. They had their whole lives ahead of them. And then you fast forward 20 years and it's like, wow, they're so ready to get out of every rehearsal. They sit down a couple seconds. This isn't about oboists. Let me be clear. I'm not saying oboists do this.
I know some oboists.
But we're not taking care of them because we're not taking care of their whole identities. Think about in other entertainment industries where you have constant player profiles of NBA stars or... Mm-hmm. Look at a huge growing sports league in America right now, the, you know, professional softball league. If you just look at those players, you know everything about them very quickly. And the other thing that's really concerning is that a lot of our orchestral musicians, I don't think they would shy away from this. I think they would actually go towards this idea because wouldn't it be great for our audiences to know that our principal bassist is also a collector of Harley Davidsons, or that your fourth hornist, she's an excellent botanist and she sells plants on the side and she makes exquisite plant sculptures. There's so much intrigue about our musicians. I mean, there must be. You can't be a creative without being a creative, not just from 10 to 12:30 Tuesday through Friday, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are so many things I want to follow. What happened with baseball in the 80s? You mentioned sports a couple times already, and so I
live for sports. I love sports. I credit any opportunity that I've ever been given because of sports. Really? I didn't think I was going to be a conductor. I was supposed to go play softball in college, and then I tore my ACL, and then I had to go find money for college. And, you know, having played violin and piano my whole life, done the youth orchestra thing, found money that way. But yeah, the league was really bad. People weren't going to games. The league wasn't really convinced that they wanted to take the chance of putting games on TV because they thought, nah, who's going to sit down and watch a whole game? Yeah. But they learned, they figured it out. They pulled players. They communicated with their audiences. I mean, baseball, though, I mean, it can rely on some really stable things being kind of in the fabric of American sports culture. But they really took the time to assess, and they took some chances. And I think to sum it up, what baseball did was they played some high-risk, high-reward strategies, and it paid off. And but we're not willing to enter arena where high risk is even whispered. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned following more for-profit models. Do you have some examples that you can share of what you've seen
of successful for-profit mindset to orchestras?
Or ways that orchestras have applied it. There are couple orchestras that are doing kind of that, but yeah, we just default to the nonprofit model and then get back to playing.
There's not a lot of good examples in classical music of for-profit mindset. The only one I've seen recently, I was just with an orchestra in Ohio. They have set themselves up for such success. They took some chances during COVID acquiring real estate and creating alliances with their local arts organizations. And they have set themselves up to be a nonprofit that operates in a for-profit mindset. They now owned enough halls and buildings that their orchestras can be serving multiple diverse communities at one time and also hosting films or hosting weddings or dance competitions. Like, that's one angle, is to, you know, actually acquire assets and use them to your advantage. But something that really concerns me, and it concerns other people, is the subscription model and how we don't really use that to our advantage to operate for-profit. How many 25-year-olds do you know that want to drop $500 at the start of the season for their... No, of course not.
No.
But those same people, they love subscription models. They absolutely love it. That's how I get my coffee, my wine, my books, my magazines. It's all a monthly fee. My stupid, you know, photo editing apps, right? It's something that we have to explore, that we have to give patrons more options on how they finance their concert hall experiences. There are many people out there who know this data more than I do, Aubrey Bergauer being one of them. Do we know if 25 to 40-year-olds would be interested in a monthly subscription to the concert hall, to the content that we create? And you know what? Chances are they might not come to more than 4 concerts a season. How many of us have the $30, $40 a month yoga subscription? And let's be honest, we go twice a month, but we still pay for it because there's a chance we might go. There's a chance we might want to take a date to the symphony. There's a chance that... my mom's birthday is coming up. Maybe I'll take her to that. Or, hey, my local orchestra is doing Harry Potter film music. I love Harry Potter. I've been paying for this app. Let me go check it out. Mm-hmm. There's not enough variety in financing for us right now.
We don't like to take risks.
No.
No. No. I'm curious about the orchestra in, you say, Ohio?
Yeah.
So was there anything besides the assets that they did differently?
You mean acquiring assets?
Mm-hmm.
It was, since they own it, it's of course attaching their marketing to anything that comes through those buildings, which is very smart. That, okay, you come to one of the venues for your wedding, that's great. You're still going to see the symphony orchestra posters and marketing. There's still going to be the option in the shop to purchase merchandise of the orchestra. So there's going to be a schedule. There's a functional marquee, all of these things. So it's putting yourself in the situation to be seen. That really is part of that for-profit mindset.
Plus the income from whatever they already own.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned earlier we don't take care of people before or after the performance itself. I mean, before we do pre-concert lectures. We may do some educational stuff. But what are some things we could do before?
Like once they're in the concert hall or before before?
Either one.
City planners don't just plan the road. And I learned this recently. Hmm. When a city planner gets a new project, they plan from facade to facade. That includes the road, the curb, the sidewalk, the shrubs, the animal path, the bike path. Like, it just keeps going, right? Mm-hmm. From facade to facade. That's what a city planner does. And that's what we have to do. I think in the time leading up to the concert, there's a chance to share information. We don't seem to realize that our audiences get info the exact same way we do. A lot of them. When we're getting ready to do Mahler 1 at the end of the season, you know, there should be a plan in place from the organization. Hey, we're going to send out A, B, and C leading up to the concert strategically to encourage audience interaction, to remind them about certain things, to encourage them for this afterwards. Also, there's this restaurant nearby that we're collaborating with. Let's do that. Hey, there's this parking garage, just so you know. All of these things. And it two things. First, it kind of loops back to our overworked staff. That's a lot to ask for every single subscription. That's a lot. However, we could take care of a lot of that by creating an environment for our players where they're so happy to be a part of this orchestra that they're doing a lot of these things on their own social media, on their own accounts, you know, that they themselves become the Mark McGuire's. Like, everyone wants to know where's Mark McGuire going to go eat, but do you know who Mark McGuire is?
Yeah.
That is the one
name besides Michael Jordan that I do know.
or let's use someone more modern, that Steph Curry. Like, yeah. What does Steph Curry think about the game tonight? Like, people are obsessed with those, right? There's no reason that you shouldn't want to know from your principal flutist, how did that go? What are you going to do before the concert? What did you like about the concert? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's one more thing that we're wasting, is we're not just wasting all the time of these musicians, but their personality and their opinion and their voice.
There was the Pulitzer Prize winning book, I think it was for 2018 or 2019, I can't remember, it's called The Overstory. And it was about our relationship to trees. It was kind of a big fable, best book ever. And if anyone's listening right now, fast forward 10 seconds so I don't spoil it for you. I did that once with a different book. It was really embarrassing. It followed these different people who cared deeply about the environment and about trees. And they made all of these efforts, all these things to try to fix the trees, to try to fix, fires. And you get to the end and you realize that the one thing that you can do to save the forest is just get out of the way. It takes care of itself. It knows what to do, you human. It was there before us. It'll be there after us. Stop. Mm-hmm. Try not making yourself the center of attention for 1 second. Mm-hmm. And that's what classical music is. It's great. And if we really honored it and cared about our art form, we would find ways to use it itself to save everything that we care about. And what makes the music are the players. They're a huge untapped revenue source, marketing source, everything.
That's beautiful.
It's a great book. Everyone should read the book. Yeah.
I'm doing a reading challenge this year, so I'll go grab that. I'll add it to my list.
Okay, cool.
What was it called again?
The Overstory.
The Overstory. Okay, perfect.
Okay.
And I actually think that's an excellent note to conclude on. Do you have anything else you want to add to that, or anything else you want to add to the discussion as a whole?
We didn't really talk about audiences.
I think we talked a lot about...
We talked about audience care.
And part of that is, orchestra care and messaging care and all the ways. Do you have something that you'd like to share? So again, the season theme is building back audiences, and we're really emphasizing that that's not just getting our old subscribers to come in. It's because that's just not viable anymore. It's both attracting new people and making sure that we take care of them enough that they actually want to come back and support our orchestras enough for us to be supported. So that's our big focus this season. And we're reminding people that it's not just getting people into the hall, it's getting them and then getting them back.
In defense of what I just said about the art form taking care of itself, I do think that also applies to our audiences. And what I mean is that even though it was on a podcast, Beethoven was having the same conversation. You know, our audiences are about to leave. And Bernstein had the same conversation, like, our audiences are all about to die off. Well, they're still there, you know? And I think it's because of the art form. I think that there's some type of timeline built in to the art how do you even say this? That at some point, you know, when you're growing up, it's not all about you anymore, right?
Yeah.
At some point, life starts taking a lot more than it gives in every way. And so you start seeking out experiences to compensate for that loss. And this is the greatest one. And I think that's why we're having the same conversation 200 years later after Beethoven and Haydn. Because it will find its own audience. We just have to make it.
We have to get it out of the way.
I don't know. I think I've contradicted myself a couple times, but I think I know what I mean. I'll figure it out. I've got some time left to figure it out.